It's been great that there's a connection between this community of faith here in Perth and our community of faith in Brisbane. Recently, Richard and Cheryl have visited here a couple of times from our community and really appreciated being a part of this gathering. When I came in today, I immediately turned to Michael and said, "It's still hard for me to adjust to not seeing Paul at the piano." And then when we sang that song, it was like the legacy continues. So that was really lovely. For the last 20 years, since 9/11 in 2001, when my relationship as a Christian with my Muslim friends was completely redefined as us against them, I have been working really intentionally on developing connections between Christians and Muslims across the divide of suspicion that there is on both sides. And one of the ways that I've been doing that is by fasting in Ramadan with my Muslim friends. And I'm not very good at it, which is why I tend to put weight on during Ramadan by eating too much when I get to evening. Physically, Ramadan's not good for my health. Spiritually, it's pretty good for me. But a lot of people, I don't know whether you know that, actually do put on weight during Ramadan, because though you fast from dawn till dusk, you eat in the evening, and not everybody shows the appropriate self-restraint. A friend of mine came up and tapped me on my tummy recently and just said, "Oh, Ramadan tummy, huh?" Anyway, so, yes. Anyway, one of the things that I've done in Ramadan through the years is I've chosen a theme to reflect on during the month of Ramadan. And each day I've shared a reflection on Ramadan. So I've got a number of books here that are summaries of some of those reflections that I've been shared that I've put on Facebook every day. And some of them have been shared nationally on Radio National during Ramadan. So on Ramadan, on the Bismillah, on the Issa. And this Ramadan I chose to meditate on one of the 99 names of God in the Quran, and that is Al-Wadud, the one who loves, the loving one. The one who is the source of all love. Now, as a follower of Jesus, my approach to interfaith dialogue is always to look for that which is Christ-like in other traditions and religions that I can affirm and confirm and celebrate with other people. Not trying to colonise, but to recognise what we have in common and to appreciate that. And I'm convinced as a Christian that one of the most distinctive revelations that we have in our scripture is the idea that God is love. It's tragic that what I consider to be the most important revelation in scripture has been left out of all our creeds. So our founding documents, check out the creeds, don't mention the love of God. But I have found fasting with my Muslim friends, it's been great to reflect on the love of God that I, as a Christian, and they, as Muslims, honour. Ibn Arabi, one of the most famous Muslim scholars, says, "The loving one, or Al-Wadud, is the one whose love is constant." And so with my Muslim friends who share that understanding of God, it's fantastic. Love is who God is, and love is what God does. A friend of mine, Mike Riddell, who died recently, wrote in his book, "The heart of God has gone out from itself to envelop the universe. Love is the source of its existence. Love is the energy streaming through it. Love, the end to which it moves. God is the one who dreamed you into being, danced with joy at your birth, tracked you down the back streets of your life, whispering to you in the night, calling you from the darkness to live in the light of his glorious love." So that's a spirituality that I believe that we can enter into from different religious traditional perspectives. Now, during the last 5 years, I've had the privilege of being on a spiritual journey of deep theological discovery with a brilliant, world-class Islamic scholar by the name of Dr. Adis Juderia. Adis is a first-generation Australian Muslim who fled Bosnia with his family when the genocidal ethnic cleansing was unleashed in former Yugoslavia. And his family found safety here. And Adis studied his PhD in religion and in Islam, and he's now the senior lecturer in study of Islam and society at the Griffith University in Brisbane. And he's a member of the network of Australian spiritual progressives, and he's a world-renowned advocate of progressive Islam, which for him means being committed to human rights, social justice, gender equity, liberation theology from an Islamic tradition. Now, as Adis and I have discussed the idea of God as Al-Wadud, the one who loves, we've both come to the conclusion that in order to truly embrace that truth, that God is the one who loves, we have had to reject many of our conventional constructions of the concept of God in our respective traditions. And I'd like to share some of those reflections with you today, not necessarily expecting you to agree with me, but I just raise them for your own thoughts. I can remember speaking in a church once where I started to preach and it became slightly controversial, and people started to walk out in ones and twos. Then whole rows of people started walking out, and I thought, before I lose the whole congregation, I just need to make it clear that if you stay, I'm not presuming you agree with me. If you stay, I'm just assuming that you're giving me the courtesy of listening to an alternative point of view, and we can discuss it and debate it afterwards. So is that a fair call? I'm not assuming that you agree with me just because I say these things in your presence. Conventional constructions of the concept of God traditionally present God in Christianity and Islam as the omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, controlling, sovereign Lord of all. Now, many of you have been brought up in one of those traditions or the other will recognise those terms as part of our theological tradition. However, Adis and I have concluded that the logic of love, the indications in our scriptures, and the gospel of Jesus all demand that we deconstruct and reconstruct this idea of God. The logic of love would suggest that a God of love could not be a coercive deity controlling people's choices and predetermining whether people would go to heaven or hell. It's just contrary to everything that we would understand as love. On the contrary, the Bible says that the Lord is compassionate and gracious, slow to act in anger, abounding in loving kindness and forgiving iniquity and transgression. And the Quran says, Allah is the ultimate source of instant beneficence and eternal mercy, who encompasses the entire universe. Every surah of the Quran except one, every chapter of the Quran except one, begins with the Bismillah, which is Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, the most merciful and compassionate. Both the Rahman and Rahim are derived from the Semitic root Rahm, which signifies the womb and the nourishing tenderness and the nurturing kindness of God. It's interesting in a religion that has strong patriarchal traditions that in this very affirmation of the nature of God is this kind of feminine aspect at the centre of the reality of God. According to Ibn Qayyim, Rahman describes the quality of limitless grace with which Al-Wadud embraces the whole of the world and all those who dwell in it, while Rahim describes that embrace of grace, of waldud, that interacts with us in the particularities of our lives, always proactive, always preventive, always compassionate, always responsive. Hence, both Addis and I believe God is more like a caring divine mother or father than a controlling, tyrannical figure. Addis recently, enthusiastically, read a book called The Nature of Love, a Theology by a Christian theologian, Thomas J. Ord. And he gave this book to me. So his, we laughed at the irony of him trying to introduce me to Christian theology to deepen my faith. Beautiful moment. In this book, The Nature of Love, a Theology by Thomas J. Ord, at the centre of it, this book, is a look at Jesus in Philippians chapter 2. Many of you are familiar with this passage, which talks about him emptying himself to identify with humanity and become one of us and to be a servant, right? And Ord actually says, that's not just a methodology, that's a theology. Christ is a representative of who God really is. The God who is there is a God who of love, is a God of love, who empties himself of all attempts to be controlling that is not loving. All attempts to manage and manipulate our lives that is not loving. Because if love is the essential characteristic of God, we need to realize that God is not controlling. Because love is not controlling. Now, if we embrace God as the one who loves, then Addis and I have come to the conclusion we should reject the traditional representation of God as omniscient and omnipotent, but still accept God as omnipresent. As I've said, if God is the one who loves, God can't be omnipotent in the sense of being all-powerful and exercising that power to manipulate everything. Because love is uncontrolling. That's the nature of love. We've come to the conclusion that God is more like a leader of a jazz band than a conductor of a classical orchestra. The conductor of a classical orchestra demands our attention and seeks to get everybody in the orchestra to play their part according to the preset written music. It's all decided beforehand. And the conductor actually controls it. So everyone plays their prescribed part in terms of the arrangement. Whereas a leader of a jazz band guides, nudges, encourages, brings people together, elicits extemporary creativity without necessarily knowing how it's going to turn out, but being committed to including and encouraging everyone's creativity to work collaboratively to create something beautiful. And Addis and I feel that our understanding of God is much more like the leader of a jazz band than a conductor of an orchestra. If God is the one who is loved, then we believe that God is not omnipotent in the traditional sense, manipulating and micromanaging everything and everyone. And he's not omniscient in the traditional sense of apprehending everything from beginning to end. We believe that if God doesn't control our choices, how can God know our choices and the consequences of our choices as certainties until we've made those choices? We believe that until then, God knows our choices and the permutations and combinations of the consequences of our choices as possibilities, but not as certainties until we have made our choice. However, because God is omniscient in the sense that he knows all the possibilities, the one who loves us knows all the possible permutations and combinations of our choices and the consequences of our choices and has redemptive options prepared for us to bring good out of evil, no matter how many mistakes we might make. Which brings us to our understanding of the omnipresence of God. When we say God is omnipresent, we're not saying that God is in the present in the past and the present in the now and the present in the future. After all, the scripture says, God says in the scripture, I am the one who was in the past, is in the present, and is to come in the future. That God works through history with us, alongside us, through the sequence of events, interacting with us as we go. The past is over and completed. It's done. The present is unfolding right now. It's happening. The future is yet to be decided. It's open. God experiences the flow of time too. The past is past for God. The present is present for God. And the future is open for God as well as for us. God is a living lover who creates, empowers, and inspires and helps us also experience reality moment by moment. Creator and creation are in process. And in the process, no matter how much of a mess it might be, God is omnipresence, as it says in Romans, for we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him and have been called according to his purpose. So God is involved in the whole process of unfolding history. Even in the middle of the mess and the chaos, God is in the middle of the mess and chaos, working together for good because he loves us and he's calling us to be the very best we can be. Now, on March 22, 2016, Mohammed El-Bakri was confronted with the tragedy of his wife, Lubna Lafkiri, was blown up on a train in Belgium, along with 15 other passengers, by an Islamic State suicide bomber by the name of Khalid El-Bakarouf. On hearing this tragedy, Mohammed El-Bakri said, I am a Muslim, first of all by birth, then by conviction. I oppose all religious fundamentalism, no matter whether it comes from Muslims or from other people of other religions. There is nothing spiritual about murder and war. What's religious about one people exterminating another people? Is a military victory a victory for God? Are the cries of the dying a symphony to the greater glory of God? After all, he is the creator of all peoples and all nations, as it says in the Quran so beautifully, O humanity, we created you from a single male and female and made you into nations and tribes that you may know one another. You'll come together, understand from each other, learn from each other, and learn to live with each other. In the face of hatred, the one who loves encouraged Mohammed El-Bakri to take up what he called a jihad for love. Vertical love from the Almighty for all those he has created. Horizontal love that we must spread for all humanity. And he says, whenever I meet someone of another faith who allows themselves to be led by love, I have the feeling that we share the same religion. And so do others and I. Now, I'd just like to play a TED talk for you of Mohammed El-Bakri talking about his jihad for love. And then we can have a time for comments or questions.
The following 10-minute video talk is in French. To watch the video with English subtitles or to read what is said, please refer to the link and translation found in the document titled Translation of Mohammed El-Bakri's tedxtalk.pdf.
Je suis Mohamed El Bachiri, belgo-marocain, musulman, molenbeekois. Avec ce prénom, ces convictions religieuses et la réputation de la commune dans laquelle je vis, je suis considéré par une partie de la population et du monde comme un terroriste potentiel. Et cela m'affecte beaucoup. Je suis également l'époux de Lubna Lafkiri, l'amour de ma vie, mon amie, la mère de mes enfants, décédée lors des attentats du 22 mars 2016 à Bruxelles. Lubna, femme à la beauté inégalable et à la bonté infinie, son regard posé sur moi, son sourire, sa présence, faisait de moi le plus beau, le plus fortuné, le plus comblé de tous les hommes. Aujourd'hui, ma tristesse est incommensurable. Et si je suis debout, ce n'est que grâce et par l'amour. Par l'amour que je porte à mon épouse, l'amour pour mes enfants, l'amour pour la vie et l'amour pour l'humanité. Amour qui m'a incité à appeler au djihad lors d'une soirée organisée dans une église où musulmans, chrétiens et autres avions partagé un repas dans un esprit de fraternité. Oui, j'ai appelé au djihad. Mais attention, pas n'importe quel djihad. Je parle de ce djihad qui ne connaît pas la haine, car la haine est un pesant fardeau qui noircit les cœurs. Je parle du vrai, du plus noble, du plus grand combat des musulmans contre la terreur. Ce djihad qui incite à aller vers les autres, son frère, différent, pour lui sourire, pour le comprendre et lui exprimer de l'empathie. Ce djihad qui aime, qui a besoin d'aimer pour exister, qui cherche l'étreinte pour éteindre les flammes de la rancœur et qui en aucun cas n'impose sa vérité. Car comme il est dit dans le Coran, « La ikraha fid din », nulle contrainte en religion. Ce djihad, mon djihad, crie d'amour pour l'Occident, cette partie du monde qui m'a vu naître et qui m'a tant donné. Moi, l'enfant de l'univers, votre frère en humanité. Et ce djihad devrait être la réponse des musulmans à ceux qui cherchent à nous diviser et à propager la violence et la terreur. Comme si dans un champ de bataille, le cri agonisant des vaincus était une symphonie à la gloire du Dieu victorieux. Maudite soit la guerre, maudit soit le terrorisme. Je reviens à l'essentiel, l'amour. Ce socle sur lequel toute pensée, toute croyance, tout être humain devrait se reposer. Elle devrait à la fois être une force universelle et la base de toute communication entre nous les êtres humains. Dans cette relation axée sur l'amour, nul n'a prétention de détenir la vérité vraie, et encore moins la volonté de l'imposer. Cette quête de vérité, nous l'avons en chacun de nous. C'est une des caractéristiques de l'animal raisonnable que nous sommes. Pour ma part, le chemin emprunté est l'islam. Et ce chemin-là est emprunté dans le but d'aller vers ce que les Grecs appelaient l'ataraxie, l'apaisement de l'âme, ce que je souhaite à chacun d'entre nous. Le chemin emprunté pour ma part est l'islam. Mais ce chemin est emprunté par ce que je suis dans un premier temps, un être humain. D'où de manière logique l'importance de mettre en avant mon humanité avant mon islamité. mon humanité avec toutes les valeurs humanistes que cela comporte, à savoir la sacralité de la vie humaine, le libre arbitre et le rapport fraternel entre tous les êtres humains. Être humaniste musulman, c'est accepter, savourer et considérer comme un privilège le fait de vivre dans la diversité. C'est aussi la capacité de contextualiser les textes du Coran, notamment les passages guerriers, et les considérer comme des récits historiques propres au 7e siècle qui ne peuvent en aucun cas être utilisés pour faire du mal ou ôter la vie à autrui. Être humaniste musulman, c'est s'intéresser à notre histoire commune, celle de l'humanité, avec tous ces grands hommes qui ont fait avancer le monde, ces hommes de la Grèce antique, de Mésopotamie, de Rome, de Chine, d'Occident et d'Orient. C'est arrêter un moment de regarder vers les cieux et se tourner vers son prochain pour lui sourire et le comprendre. Et si mon prochain est à l'antipode de ce que je pense, de ce que je crois, ce n'est pas grave. Car comme disait Héraclite, il y a vérité dans une chose et dans son contraire. Pour ma part, moi-même, je suis contradiction, partagée entre raison et mysticisme, conviction et scepticisme, mais toujours et jusqu'au dernier souffle, portée par l'amour. En ces temps difficiles et incertains, j'appelle au dialogue et à l'échange, et plutôt que de s'attarder sur la haine et la folie des uns, tournons-nous vers le génie et la bonté de l'humanité. Car c'est, et cela restera, la source d'inspiration et d'espoir pour ceux à qui nous empruntons la terre, nos enfants. Je soulignerai aussi l'importance de la culture, car c'est ce qui mène à l'ouverture. Et quand je vois Averroès, ce philosophe musulman, qui a traduit, qui a permis la traduction de nombreux textes grecs et commenté également de nombreux textes grecs et a permis la transmission, par conséquent, a permis la transmission de la majeure partie de la pensée aristotélicienne à l'Occident, ce qui a contribué quelque part à la Renaissance. Et quand je le vois immortalisé au palais du Vatican dans une fresque de par les mains de Raphaël, je ne peux que ressentir une grande émotion et constater que nous, musulmans, pouvons et avons déjà auparavant contribué à la grandeur de l'Occident et de l'humanité. Et que finalement, il n'y a pas de choc de civilisation, mais de magnifiques rencontres. J'aimerais conclure et terminer par un texte que j'ai écrit peu après la disparition de mon épouse. C'était pour moi une réponse à ceux qui ont détruit ma vie et mon bonheur. Ce texte s'intitule « Allahu Akbar ». Et je pense que c'est le « Allahu Akbar » de la plupart des musulmans. « Allahu Akbar », doux murmure provenant du cœur, qu'on ne peut entendre, mais tellement plus vrai que celui utilisé pour détruire. « Allahu Akbar » pour l'amour que je porte au plat pays qui est le mien et au royaume chérifien. « Allahu Akbar » pour la beauté, pour l'art, pour cette œuvre qui dégage une émotion si forte qu'elle ferait fondre en larmes le plus glacial des cœurs. « Allahu Akbar » pour cette diversité, pour ces cultures, ces croyances, ces gens avec lesquels on discute, on échange et on accepte que finalement, chacun détient sa vérité dans un esprit de fraternité. « Allahu Akbar » lorsqu'on réprouve la violence et qu'on œuvre pour la paix et l'amitié entre les peuples. Allahu Akbar lorsque je souris et je tends la main à toi le juif, l'athée ou le chrétien. Allahu Akbar pour ceux qui ont compris que Dieu est amour et que le salut de l'homme ne viendra qu'à travers cette force universelle exprimée pour son prochain. Allahu Akbar, douce pensée et prière pour toi, Loubna, mon amour, et pour toutes les victimes qui vivront à jamais dans nos cœurs et dans nos mémoires. Je vous remercie.
So is there anything in what I shared or what Brother Muhammad shared with you that resonated with you that you'd like to respond to?
I just feel if we really understood what you said and then this finale of what he said, it is absolutely life-changing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Say no more.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I think the idea that love is not controlling is just colossal. And it does change a whole lot of frameworks. Yeah, very useful idea for me.
It's interesting that in Queensland at the moment, we've actually just passed a law against coercive control because we need that as the foundation of violence in families. So why do we still have it in our theology? Anyway, just a thought.
I was just thinking about my silly kid story, but that idea that being loved by a parent doesn't necessarily mean getting what we want. And I was just reflecting on that man received the absolute antithesis of what he wanted in life.
Yes.
And it stimulated that.
Yeah.
Which is just unbelievable.
Yeah, really quite unbelievable. And I think something to note is that I grew up in a church tradition that demonised Muslims and basically said Christians have a monopoly on love. These people who are not Christians do not really know anything about love. Anybody else grow up in that kind of tradition? And and to be in conversation with so many Muslims who are not only discovering that the God who is there is a God of love, but her discovering that is the essential character of God by which they need to define and redefine everything else. It's truly wonderful and transformative. And that's a joy to be on that journey.
That's kind of what I was going to say. I find it, I mean, from what you said today, Dave, our conversation, I just find it so deeply encouraging and refreshing to hear you talk of progressive Muslims who are deeply committed to their spirituality and to wrestling with their tradition as you model we are. So I thought that's the first thing. The other is a simple thing, is from reading the book Empire Baptized that you put me onto, is to realise that my understanding of reading that book is that all of the creeds we've grown up with were developed quite early, a lot of them, and were developed as a tool to deal with the fighting between Christian denominations.
That's right.
Not as an outreach.
Yes.
So I find that incredibly stunning and important to realise.
Just to respond to the first part of what Michael was saying, in the way I engage in faith dialogue, I try to practice two things. The first is to be intentionally appreciative of that which is good in the other tradition. Right? You know, as it says in the scriptures, whatever is good, think about these things. Right? So to be intentionally appreciative about what is good in other traditions. So I have that approach. The second thing is to be critically reflective. There are bad things in all our religions, but it only exacerbates the conflicts if we focus on what's bad in the other religion. We have to remember that as followers of Jesus, we're called to take the log out of our own eye before we try to take the speck out of somebody else's. So we encourage people not to be critically projective to look what is bad in other religions, but to be critically reflective to look what is bad in our religion that's preventing the development of this relationship. So we're intentionally appreciative of the good in others, but we seek to be critically reflective of anything bad within our tradition that actually would inhibit the development of that relationship. And what is more, we try to support our brothers and sisters in other traditions to be critically reflective in their tradition. So rather than us dealing with that stuff in a way that just escalates conflict, in-house, we try to deal with the stuff that we've got to deal with ourselves. Does that make sense? So it's not like we avoid the bad things, but each of us deal with the bad things within our own traditions, rather than project blame onto the other and then just escalate the conflict. So Addis is dealing with all the issues of gender inequity within his tradition and advocating gender equity in the face of Wahhabism and Salafism and so on, which you can imagine is very, very challenging. But I need to deal with the same in my own tradition, my own lack of regard for people of all genders and gender fluidity. Does that make sense? Okay.
You raised, you were talking about the dichotomy of God as omnipotent and controlling and that terminology versus, I can't remember the opposite, but the jazz band leader. I wonder if there's somewhere in between with a God who has the capacity for omnipotence, but love manifests in a way that isn't controlling and manipulative and so forth. And exactly what that looks like will be different in different places. I've recently become aware of key differences in parenting practices in, you know, Australia and Switzerland, just for two examples that I've come across recently, that, you know, there's people there that would see the way we do parenting as extremely controlling, which surprised me a lot. But I think about that, about the way we do church and the way we consider God as whether God is controlling and manipulative or a loving parent who nudges, might be in the eye of the beholder to some extent.
The issue you raised is a very important one, and it's an ongoing discussion in Christian circles. There's traditional theology that actually argues for this kind of all-powerful sovereign God who is in charge of everything and whose will is always done, right? Then there are those who advocate what's called process theology, which is what I'm talking about, where God is a creator God who's involved in the creation process in an ongoing way that is interactive, and where there's an understanding that we are called to be co-creators in a history that is not yet fixed. Right? That's that view. Now, in the middle, the kind of thing that you're suggesting is what's called open theology or open theism, which actually argues that God can be all-powerful and overpowering when he needs to, but then chooses to limit his power in order to create a space for others to develop their own power. But at any time, he can choose to overpower people to intervene. Do you understand what I'm saying? Can I just say that there's one difficult problem with that? Why does not God intervene in the Holocaust? If God at any time can intervene and do that, then God is culpable for not doing it. So I don't mean to have a cheap shot. I'm just saying that's one of the difficulties of that position. Whereas the view that I'm advocating, which you may or may not agree with, it's certainly not held by all Christian communities, is one that actually argues that the God being love inherently, intrinsically, is non-controlling but only engages constantly through nudging and encouraging and trying to influence, but not by controlling. And let me give you the great example of how I think that operates. There was a missionary by the name of Gladys Aylward. Has anybody ever heard of her? Gladys Aylward. She was a poor woman in England, very uneducated, wanted to go to China. The China Inland Mission wouldn't take her because she was too illiterate. She saved up her money for making tea, then bought a ticket on the Trans-Siberian Express. And during the period between the two world wars, she travelled by herself all the way through Russia, was captured, had to escape, went to Japan, got a boat back into China. Anyway, and just before the Japanese invaded and all these kids had to flee, and she took all these orphans up into the mountains. And she was a tough, cockney, And I heard her speak once, and she said, I can't do the accent, but she said, every night I used to get up on the roof and say to God, don't send me any more kids. I've only got enough room in my heart and my home for 40 kids. So don't send me any more. And next time I'd go downstairs and there'd be 40 more kids. And then she said, so I thought, oh, that prayer's not working. I better pray something else. So she said, every night from then on, I got up and said, God, if you're going to send me all these kids, send somebody to help me. Why don't you listen to me? And then she said, God leaned out of heaven and said, Gladys, I hear you. I can't not hear you. You yell at me every night. And God said to her, she says, every night I hear your cry. And every night I talk to people around the world and whisper in their hearts, go and help Gladys. You think the problem is that I don't listen to you. The problem is no one listens to me. Anyway, I just offer that as a practical example of that kind of theology in process. Somebody else over here?
I'm about halfway through reading the Quran myself, and every single chapter through there, it always starts the same way. In the name of God, merciful to all, compassionate to each. There's something about the preparing of for the text just with those few words before going through there. And just this nature of love and compassion, I get struck with this questioning of if this text can be such a beacon of love and compassion, then how have we got to this stage now where there seems to be this huge divide between Islam as practiced by those in the West compared to those in the East? And there might be parallels with Christianity, not in entire countries, perhaps, like why we have in Saudi Arabia, but with someone who's stumbled into Westboro Baptist Church, perhaps they have to toe the party line there. But then the separation between Muslim men in Belgium and Muslim women in Belgium who can expect that their husbands will be loving partners to them versus Muslim women in Iran who have to prepare for beatings, and how this kind of separation can come about on such a large scale, which escapes me a little bit.
Okay, thank you. I gather we're moving towards the time we need to wrap this up, but let me preface my response to you specifically to your question by saying my definition of spirituality is the experience and expression of the spirit of compassion for the other. But religion is the ideation of that experience and the institutionalization of that expression that simultaneously affirms and negates the expression of a true spirit of compassion for the other. So I think within each religion, there are profound contradictions, right? There are those things that reflect the reality of God's love that's in our text, but there are other things in our text that seem to be completely contrary to that, right? And all people of faith need to confront those contradictions in their religions. Certainly all the contradictions you're talking about in Islam are ones that my Muslim friends would agree with and challenge. And they see it as their responsibility to practice the Bismillah and Bismillah spirituality and Bismillah politics to critically engage that kind of oppression and exploitation.
Bismillah was the translation of that, sorry?
Bismillah ya Rahman al-Rahim. It's what you said at the beginning of every verse in the Quran. In it's the name of God, the most merciful and compassionate. In fact, they argue that what they're arguing is too many Muslims take that as a kind of a verse of praise that you say by rote before you get into the text. But they are saying we need to take that as the framework for interpreting the text. So if there's anything in the text that doesn't, or our understanding of the text, that is not merciful and gracious, it is not of God. Because the Bismillah should be the framework for all religious practice. It should be full of mercy and grace. And those that are us that are followers of Jesus, not just Christians, followers of Jesus, and Jesus called to love others as he loved us, we need to find a way of interpreting everything within our tradition in the light of mercy and grace too. I think I better leave it there, if that's okay. Thank you for your attention. Yeah, there's a whole range of my books there. If you want to talk to me about them afterwards, I can share them with you.